I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency to order Thursday, May 16th. Colleagues, we're going to start at the top of the agenda today, and we'll see how that proceeds from there. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 617A. Bob, give us a brief description of Senate Bill 617A, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 617A requires the Appraiser Certification and Licensure Board to convene a panel of appraisers to determine whether objective basis exists to believe that an alleged violation has occurred, prohibits disciplinary action by the board if the panel finds an objective basis does not exist.
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I know that Senator Winters was not going to be able to be here, but I think she has staff here, and also Representative Clem.
Can I bring somebody with me?
Sure. We're on Senate Bill 617A.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian Clem, State Representative from District 21 here in Salem, and pleased to talk to you in support of Senate Bill 617A, passed out of the Senate, I think with 29 votes, and I don't know if the last one was a no or an absent, but broad support, came out of the Senate committee unanimously as well. And Kevin is sort of probably the real expert, having worked in this arena a little bit on some cases, but Kevin and I have known each other a long time. We talked about this summer, and the issue essentially is at the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board, the current situation and process with the kind of interaction between the board and a limited number of staff, small agency, has folks interested in having potentially another set of eyes in some circumstances, and that's what this bill's about. It's about the ability direction to the board to have a panel of three state-licensed appraisers that would take another look. So it's not only, for example, the investigator and the agency director making these decisions, that you would also have some other parties involved in from the industry, making sure that there's an objective basis before we move into the disciplinary proceedings. And this isn't the first time that I've been involved with Senator Winters on some legislation around this board. This is a little bit different take. Last time we were looking for a report to try and get some information, and she hasn't received it. I haven't received it. I don't think the legislature's received it. If we have, we haven't seen it. So this is another effort to try and find a way to get some just a little different look for people who are engaged in this. And it's a very serious matter if you're engaged in a disciplinary issue with your licensing board. You know, it has significant effects, even if you're found not to have a problem, it still has significant effects on your business and your job. And so that's why we care about this. And then I can let Kevin talk a little bit more about, from his experience, what he knows and what the bill's about.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kevin Lafke, and I'd also signed up in speaking in support of the bill. Representative Clem is correct. This is a so-called semi-independent agency, and so as a result, you, the legislature, have a little less control over them compared to the standard governmental agencies. And it's a small agency, but it has a lot of authority, of course, penultimate authority over all of the appraisers in Oregon. And the composition of this agency is such that the administrator has an extraordinary amount of control over this process. The administrator can file a complaint, and this doesn't matter who the administrator is. This isn't personal in any way. This is just a description of the structure of this agency. The administrator can file a complaint. Board members have stated that they have delegated significant power to the administrator to determine the potential sanction that an appraiser might receive in a disciplinary matter, and then ultimately the administrator, even after an administrative law judge has conducted a hearing, the administrator then passes muster over what that ALJ has decided. So, in other words, this is an extraordinary amount of power that's vested in a single administrator, and while that's true with all of our governmental agencies, having another set of eyes on the decision-making process always seems like a good idea. This won't slow the process down. This won't hamper the process. This won't create any problems in disciplining people who deserve to be disciplined, but it will add another layer of accountability to this agency and help appraisers make sure that they're getting a fair shake when they get reviewed for these kinds of matters.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we anticipate that this bill will go to Ways and Means, or do you think it's going to go straight to the floor? Should it get a work session?
I'll have to review the fiscal impact statement and probably check in with the Speaker's office on that as well. Can't answer that question right at the moment.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chair, it does have a fiscal impact of $110,000, but obviously it came from the Senate without it, so I think it is a good question. I don't know the answer either.
Yeah, well, the Senate has other rules, I think.
Do they? Do they have rules?
You shouldn't see the bathroom.
Okay.
So I'm sort of curious, what brings this bill on. I haven't really talked to Senator Winters at this point about this issue. And is there some failure of the board to, because is it not the board's responsibility to discipline, and they have and I know that the board is signed up as well, and they have a director who must, staff the board and make recommendations probably to the board. But is the board made up of a panel of appraisers now? Maybe this is a question for the next testifiers and all. And so I'm wondering why the current system isn't working.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it is. The board is currently composed of appraisers. This body, this legislature, addressed some issues with that board's semi-independent status in the special session last year. That's the report that Representative Clem referred to that still hasn't been received. And so I certainly can't speak for the legislature, but I think there were concerns by some legislative members in that special session and currently about accountability and responsibility. And those concerns have manifested themselves in the disciplinary process, again, just to make sure that a person who is potentially subject to discipline is going to receive a fair shake and have more eyes on the process, and that there's not just a small connected group of people that are passing muster. Some of the issues that were brought up in the House hearings, in the Senate hearings on this bill included, who will be on this panel and will they have the expertise to accomplish this if it's a more complex disciplinary process, or, we're already really doing this already. And so, all of those questions can be answered in the rulemaking process and in the implementation of this bill. It never seems like a bad idea to codify something when someone says, well, we're doing it this way already. That certainly doesn't seem to be an argument against the bill. That would suggest to me an argument for it.
Thank you. I'm still a little bit, mystified by we have a board in place and now we're appointing, and we have several other boards. Do other boards, are we doing this with other boards as well to add an additional, sub-board to make oversee decisions or to make recommendations to the board. I mean, we have the Construction Contractors Board, I think, similar type of board where you have an executive director and board members from the industry that basically look at contractors, and I'm familiar with that one, that have the ability to look at violations and propose sanctions or other sorts of actions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the lawyer model is probably a good one. The lawyers have a board of governors who are elected to have the general oversight, and at the same time, the bar has a state professional responsibility board that's another set of eyes that reviews disciplinary matters and recommends on those issues. And so, again, our position is that an extra set of eyes, extra accountability, and extra review is always a good thing, especially when you have a small, tightly knit community here that sometimes you may have relationships between board members, relationships between the administrator and board members, and without getting into, you know, specific cases and concerns that may have come up out of specific cases, I think it's better just to characterize it as a potential for a problem when you have this kind of situation and you don't have as much of a review and responsibility.
I have a question.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I understand the problem, I think, but I wonder if there are other ways to get at the solution, particularly because there's a fiscal and you know, I've been studying medical boards more than this arena, but the panel that would be chosen would also be appraisers, certified appraisers. So the idea of having an independent view outside that tightly knit community that all knows each other doesn't seem to be addressed by this particular solution. And I wonder if there are other ways to look at where the authority lies. Right now it sounds like there's a lot placed in an administrator. But a board, presumably you have a public member. Usually boards have a public member in addition to the appraisers.
And this one does.
Right. So, you know, it seems like looking at lines of authority, you know, is the authority placed where it should be? Composition of the board? Those are some of the things, I guess, for your panel as well as those to follow. I would love to know what other solutions have been discussed and dismissed and why we landed on this particular solution.
So if I might as well, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, actually, not just Representative Kinney-Geyer, you know, I served on a board for a long time at a state level, but it wasn't a disciplinary board, but it sometimes did deal with things like the adverse impact process, and there is a close-knit relationship that forms between the commissioners and themselves. Mm-hmm. And the staff. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we brought in independent people from the financial aid community who weren't on our commission and weren't on our staff and weren't being staffed by us to use their professional judgment to look at situations. And it was, I thought, helpful because there is a camaraderie that it forms when you're on a commission, especially for 6, 7, 8 years with people. Mm-hmm. And you trust the staff as well. Almost implicitly. Well, you know, in the one I was in, it didn't always work out that well. We ended up having some challenges and had to ask the staff to resign. But we thought they were the greatest, you know, folks in the world until we asked the customers. So at least in the one I was on for a long time, you know, it was helpful to have other people involved. And these, what we're talking about are people who aren't on the board or commission. They're in the industry, but there's lots and lots of people in the industry that are not known and don't serve on the board regularly. So I would, you know, I'd say that. I also don't have any objection to, A, going through what's been looked at, or B, looking at other models. But we're almost out of time. This bill's passed the Senate almost unanimously, so I would say I'm totally happy to engage in that. If the bill can't make it through, I guess I'll try and engage in it in the next, like, 5 days. If it can, I'd engage in it for 2014.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, in response to your question, Representative, yes, a lot of different alternatives were looked at in the drafting and the workup of this bill, and I believe that the consensus has been that this is the best, most simple, elegant way to create an additional layer of review, and obviously you have expertise and there might be other models that would make more sense to you, but this is the one that all the heads behind this have come up with as the best, simplest way to do this.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. It's still a little unclear to me. You know, this is government efficiency, and it appears that we're putting another layer of bureaucracy over the top of an existing board to do the same job that the board's already tasked with doing. And so I'm going to, you know, I'll have to investigate this, have some conversations offline. I guess maybe it'll pop up in the further testimony about what's going on here. So
I'll send Senator Winters your way as well to explain what she was thinking, because she's been working a lot harder than I have.
Yes.
I'll be honest about that.
Yeah, she
yeah.
just visited me just briefly and
okay,
said
sure.
She wasn't able to be here. So, okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Bob Keith and Deneen Fry. Good afternoon, and if you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Deneen Fry. I'm currently the chair of the ACLB. I'm from Medford. And I want to thank you for giving us an opportunity to talk today. Before I get into what I had planned to talk about this afternoon, if I may just answer your question about the composition of our board. We are an eight-member board. We have five certified appraisers on the board. Four of them are residential appraisers. One is a commercial appraiser. We have a member from the lending community. We have a gentleman from Albany who is a banker, and he's very active with our board. We have a public member, and we have our newest composition is a representative familiar with appraisal management companies, since we now have regulatory authority over management companies as well as appraisers. So that is our composition. We're not taking a position for or against the bill. The board as a whole has taken a neutral position. But I have submitted to you some written testimony that raises a bit of a concern about the fiscal cost of the plan, the proposal, and also was intended to bring you up to date a little bit on some of the things that we have been doing. We've heard some criticism that an awful lot of the authority of the board has been delegated to our administrator in the past, and there is some truth to that. There were some specific reasons for that. It had to do primarily with some difficulties that we were having with our compliance with our federal regulatory mandates. Those things have been resolved. We are now in, I think, as my testimony points out, very good stead with the appraisal subcommittee. And we are now in a position to take a look at some things. We have new board members. If memory serves me correctly, seven of our eight members have served on the board less than 4 years. Four of the eight members are in their first year on the board. So we have a lot of new blood. I am finishing my first year as board chair, so I think it's fair to say that there's some new leadership on the board as well. And we have reached a consensus that we feel we want to be more involved with things, more involved with not just the policy decisions, but with other decisions, day-to-day decisions in terms of our enforcement and investigative procedures. And because of that, in January, before this bill was introduced, I created an enforcement oversight committee within our board. It is a three-member panel. The chair of the committee is our senior-most member of the board with 5 years' experience. He is a certified residential appraiser, and he is a nationally certified USPAP instructor. Also serving on our board as our AMC representative, who happens to be the a certified residential appraiser.
And before you go on, for the committee's information, what is AMC and what is USAP?
AMC, I'm sorry, is Appraisal Management Company. And USPAP is...
Uniform Standards and Practices.
This is our little USPAP book. These are our ethics and professional standards. This is what we refer to in our industry as the Appraiser's Bible. And I hope that no one finds that offensive. When we receive a complaint, considering a complaint, we're holding it to these standards as to whether or not there's a violation. So I'd be glad
those
to share.
Those are federal standards that...
These are nationally adopted standards, established by an organization called the Appraisal Standards Committee of the Appraisal Foundation. The Appraisal Foundation is an organization that was created by Congress as a result of the savings and loan crisis from some years ago now. The Standards Board, Appraisal Standards Board of the Appraisal Foundation, is charged with developing minimum standards of professional appraisal practice nationwide. And all appraisers, all licensed and certified appraisers, are bound to follow those at a minimum.
Okay.
I also...
I'm going to try to speed up a little bit here, but so just to cut to the chase a little bit, that those standards are what the appraisal board would be looking at to determine whether a disciplinary action or a violation of this, I guess, the practice of an individual appraiser has taken place?
Yes.
Okay,
now,
thanks.
The reason I made the point about the USPAP instructor status, you have to be a nationally certified USPAP instructor to be able to teach fellow appraisers these minimum standards of professional practice. Appraisers are required to take these standards before they ever become licensed or certified, and they're required to take an update of these standards every 2 years, taught by a nationally certified instructor. There are, out of over 100,000 appraisers nationwide, there are 500 that have achieved this instructor status. There are 9 in Oregon. 2 of them are on our staff, and 2 of them are on our board. One of those 2 on our board is the chairman of the panel we created in January, to just make all that track.
Okay, thanks.
Our panel has been charged with working with our staff, overseeing the complaint and investigation process, reviewing the files and the complaints and so forth, and making a recommendation to the board as a whole about proceeding with disciplinary action or not proceeding if it's found that there was no violation.
And you're talking about a panel that you've created, not the panel in the bill?
Out of our board.
Is it the same panel that's described in the board?
No.
Or in the bill?
No.
Okay. Thanks.
No. This is a group, from a subgroup, if you will, from our 8-member board.
Okay.
That will serve as a screening and an oversight panel to work with the staff on the individual cases, and then ultimately bring recommendations concerning discipline or sanctioning or whatever to the board as a whole, which will then make the final decision about things.
Can I ask one more question?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you. Can you tell me how much the licensing fees are per year or per every 2 years, however often they have to be paid? And how many licensees you have?
And how many licensees? Representative Kenny Geyer, we currently have approximately 1,430 licensees in the appraisal side. Our fees at the moment are $500 for a 2-year period for our licensing fees. There are some additional fees that go directly to the federal government.
And follow up, Chair?
Oh.
So the 110 million, presumably because boards have to absorb the cost among their licensees. Have you figured out how much that would be per licensee?
The bill?
Yeah. I mean, 110,000.
That it would be, I believe it was $96 for a two-year period, which may not seem like a lot of money, but appraisers are in a fairly difficult position at the moment. We have a lot of attrition. We have, in a lot of cases, appraisers who are experiencing reduced fees and reduced business, and so that 20% increase in fees, it could be significant to them.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Fry, for driving up and being a part of this and for your service on the board.
Thank you.
To kind of focus on what's really going on here, we're being asked to focus on this one board and impose a layer that will enable kind of a separate oversight in the in instances where an appraiser is being investigated, you know, something like that. Why do you think we're here? I mean, if things were going very well, we wouldn't be asked to change the law just to try and provide a workaround to the way the board normally works. Why do you think that that we're here?
Chairman Hovey, Representative Richardson, I think that there have been a number of issues that have been raised about the board over the past several years. And I don't want to belabor your time with all of that, but I'm not sure that the general population that's involved with appraisers and licensing and so forth is totally aware of the change of direction and the change of attitude that we've had with our board and some of the things that we have started to implement. And I'm not sure that they're aware of those things. I created the committee, this three-person committee, at the end of January. The bill was introduced in February. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Perhaps people are not aware.
Fine.
Or perhaps they feel it's not enough.
Fair answer. One follow-up question. A report was mentioned, that a report was requested by this body a year ago, and it still hasn't been received. And so if there's been this change, what is that report, and why has that not been provided to Senator Winters and to Representative Clinton?
Chair Halvey and Representative Richardson, I'm not sure where the report is at the moment, but I do know that Mr. Keith, our administrator, and I worked on that report, and it was to be transmitted as required before May 1st. We worked on it while we were at the Aero Conference in Austin, Texas, to make sure that it was done on time. And I'm not sure what office it went to. Perhaps Bob can enlighten
me. Yeah, why don't we move on with Bob, and if you can, if there's, don't repeat testimony, if you can just answer a few questions. We're running behind schedule already. So
thank you, Representative Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Bob Keith. I'm the administrator of the Appraiser Certification Licensure Board. I live in Clackamas County, Oregon. I'm quite concerned listening to Representative Klim's testimony. He did not receive the report. Apparently none of you have. We emailed that report in accordance with ORS 192 on May 1st to every state legislator, and we posted it on our website at www.oregonaclb.org. And it's right there, the very first thing on the website. It was delivered on time. I will go back to my office, and if I have to copy it and personally deliver it to all legislators, we worked very hard to get that report done, to do a good job on it, and to get it delivered on time and under budget. And I'm very disturbed that members of the legislature may think that we have not followed our responsibilities with Senate Bill 1587. The other thing that I would like to mention is that, contrary to previous testimony, when an administrative law judge issues a proposed final order, it does not go to me for my approval. It goes to our board, and the board meets in executive session in the presence of their attorney, discusses a report, and then the board votes on a roll call vote before they issue a final order. That's it. I could answer probably just about any question that you might have. I could also ramble on for a long time, and that's not going to serve your purpose. And so, out of respect for your time, I'll end my testimony at this point. I'll be happy to try to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Lively.
So, I just see from the written testimony that it goes back and talks about some history, and the history talks about complaints not being adjudicated or taken care of in the time frame that's required, which is 1 year, I understand. And it talked about at some point 65. So, I guess my question is trying to understand kind of the root of this again. So today, given what you've talked about with the board and that, so today is the board or whoever is, has to be in compliance with that 1 year standard, that the cases are, something happens within you are in compliance with that standard?
To date, there are three cases that are beyond the 1 year limit. All three of them are in contested hearings cases that are in the judicial process.
Okay.
And so we have no control over that.
Sure.
But the others, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? I'm not seeing any at more questions at this time, and we'll probably have some more conversations about what's going on here. And we've got a few more people to testify, so we'll
thank you.
Listen
thank
to them. So up next, I have Diane Forsberg and Michelle Kinnison. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is Diane Forsberg. I'm a certified residential real estate appraiser working here in Salem. Do you want me to proceed with my testimony?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm a member of the National Association of Appraisers. I sit on the board for the National Association of Independent Fee Appraisers, the Portland Rose City chapter. I have been the past president of the Oregon Appraisers Coalition, and I'm here today as a concerned appraiser and representing none of those. 617A, this bill would create an additional volunteer review panel who would work with the ACLB and with their staff on allegations against appraisers. This panel, as I understand it, would be would have the option of reviewing the allegations that come in, and if they see that there is merit to them, then they would request the reports and the files and further take that further. And then if they believe that there is merit to that, then they would transfer it on to the ACLB staff and board. Now, this bill also states that the panel has authority to pick and choose which allegations that they want to move on. If they only choose one in the file, one allegation, and there are more, the board or the staff does not have the ability to review the rest of them, no matter how egregious those mistakes are. So what that does is it denies the ability to pursue the other mistakes, the staff's ability to pursue the other mistakes, and thus limiting their ability to perform, the staff's ability to perform to up to federal regulation. So, you know, pretty simply put, it's going to muzzle the staff on doing their job, basically. In January, Danny talked about the ACLB that created a standing subcommittee called the Enforcement and Oversight Committee. As you heard, it's a highly qualified committee, and they've already started to review reports, and they're doing basically what this panel is already, what this panel would be set up to do. And they're doing it within their they're doing it within their volunteer duties as board members and with no fiscal impact to this agency. Just a final comment, I would like to tell you that I personally been through the complaint process and have some knowledge of how it works. It wasn't fun, but as I went through the process and I was speaking with the staff appraiser compliance analyst, what struck me was the professional manner in which that it was handled. What I did was I had a conversation with him. It was a fact-finding conversation, and at any point during this conversation, I was able to dispute what he was saying, defend my report. Or actually follow my sword and take it as a learning experience. He fully explained what the complaint was about, how it affected the report, and how I was in violation of USPAP. Now, my complaint, that was the end of it, my complaint was dismissed. But, you know, I hope that never happens again. But if it does, I am very comfortable with the current staff. And the board, because they have the knowledge and the proven experience to back up their decisions. So in conclusion, what I think we need to do is allow this enforcement and oversight committee to have time to do what they do. We don't need another layer. Let's see if it works. You know, give us some time. And I would ask you to vote no on this bill. And I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and get your testimony as well?
Hi, I'm Michelle Kennison. I'm a certified residential appraiser in down in the Medford area. I wanted to come to testify today because, as Diane explained, she has been through a complaint process, but her complaint was dismissed. I've been through an entire complaint process that was very, very serious. I was accused of fraud, amongst many, many other things. So I wanted to come today because as I went through that process, first of all, I wasn't happy I was there. I was extremely upset and extremely nervous about myself and my future in appraising. But here's what I found. The process has been in place for many, many years. The process has worked and has been successful for many, many years. With this new bill, 617, we're layering another, putting another layer on the onion, where we're doing a whole other separate process that's going to take time. It's going to take money. Who picks these people that are going to be on this committee? What is their experience going to be? And, you know, could they form relationships where they don't like an appraiser, so they put that one into the complaint process and let another one go? Our board has more than 75 years of experience, the board and the employees of the board. That's an awful lot of accumulated experience and knowledge to have. And so adding three people that may not have anywhere near the knowledge, I question that. I really do. If I can just tell you a little bit about my experience, is that okay?
Well, if you could summarize, it'd be better for us. I think we're sort of getting the gist of, two different sides of what this is doing. It sounds like it's kind of partly being done already and maybe, and so anyway.
Well, to summarize my experience, you know, there's a step-by-step process that you go through. You follow the rules. If you don't follow the rules, it kind of upsets the apple cart. I went through every step. It was very grueling at times, and a lot of times I wanted to give up. But what I did is I decided to make this a learning process, and take the opportunity to make lemonade out of lemons. And I'm so grateful that I did that, because my career has blossomed. And when a career could have really gone downhill, I think it all depends on the appraiser's attitude and ability to work with the board. We all make mistakes. And so I'd like to see a no vote on this bill.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I actually have a comment. And I'm looking at everyone who's testified so far. It really surprises me you folks would want to come to the Capitol and raise these type of issues. For this committee, if you don't know, the licensing requirements for appraisers is extraordinarily restrictive, to the point where one could almost say there's kind of a monopoly process that is involved to become a licensed appraiser. You have to receive educational experience from a licensed appraiser in Oregon. So someone has to pick you and say, okay, I'll let you work with me. And so there's very tight control, and it just surprises me that we would want to play this type of issue out in front of the legislature, knowing that the legislature could also step back and say, let's take a whole look at the industry in its entirety. And I just wanted to share that with you.
All right. I appreciate that, but I'm getting the sense that these individuals didn't bring the bill forward.
No, I know that. I'm just looking at everyone here on this.
So anyway, I appreciate you coming and sharing with us your position on the bill and your experience with the board and everybody's testimony. And we'll have another conversation offline about this. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 617. And we have everybody here. So I'm going to not go in order.
That's surprising.
So we are going to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 814. Bob, give us a brief description on Senate Bill 814, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 814 is the measure that expands the Oregon Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act by providing a right of action for unfair environmental claims settlement practices, requires coverage of damage to third-party property and expenses to mitigate damage, and establishes a right to independent counsel and environmental consultants provided by the insurer in certain circumstances. This measure has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and I'll make the committee aware that there's an opinion has been provided by legislative counsel, which is available in OLIS.
Thank you. And committee, you know, to follow up with that introduction, we did have representatives from Stoll Reeves with their opinion on this bill and why it was needed, and Paul DeMunis came in and testified with the Pacific Insurance Association with a contrary opinion to the Stoll Reeves opinion, and I understood that Senator Shields had beat me to the punch and had asked legislative counsel for an opinion since this bill did come from his committee. And so we have a copy of that opinion. I've looked at it, but I wanted to have Dexter Johnson come up and just briefly walk through a couple of the main points of the opinion without reading it. So, Dexter, if you'd please. Good afternoon, and if you'd introduce yourself for the record, because I didn't really do it.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and yes, Mr. Chair, you in fact did do it. So I'm, mentioned, I'm here to discuss with you some questions concerning the constitutionality of Senate Bill 814, and in particular, the effect of, well, let me touch base to begin with on two aspects of Senate Bill 814 that potentially raise constitutional questions. First, the bill, as Mr. Chair, you and staff mentioned, it amends the Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act, and it applies those changes both prospectively and retroactively. It applies those changes to comprehensive general liability insurance policies, which are a form of contract. And this is what raises the constitutional question. There is both in the state constitution and the federal constitution a provision that prohibits laws from impairing the obligation of contracts. And so the question becomes, given that this bill is written to apply retroactively, does that impair the obligation of contract? And my conclusion was that it does not. And the core of my conclusion turns on Section 4, Subsection 8 of the bill. It's over on page 5. And while I promised it, Mr. Chair, that I wouldn't read very much, I'm going to read this particular very short subsection, which is, it says that the rules of construction set forth in this section, in Sections 2 and 7 of the bill, do not apply if application of the rule results in an interpretation that is contrary to the intent of the parties when executing the insurance policy. And so what that means in ordinary language is, when looking at one of these insurance policies, one of these kinds of contracts, you can determine the intent of the parties, and that intent is something different than one of these rules, it's going to be the contract language, not the statutory language, that will control. And therefore, my conclusion is there is, in fact, no impairment here, because when there is a conflict, it's going to not be the statute, it's going to be the contract language that will control. And that's my principal conclusion, but I also want to go on and address the constitutionality further, because arguably, let's assume for the sake of argument, in fact, that someone determines, well, this is an impairment. It still isn't an unconstitutional impairment, in my opinion. And the reason for that has to do with case law surrounding what is meant by an unconstitutional impairment of contract at both the federal level and the state level. And they use the same analysis. And it's a three-level analysis. And it, first, is there a significant impairment of the bargained for obligation that the contract represents? And there's a particularly heavy burden of finding that impairment in the context of heavily regulated industries. There are cases out there that conclude that the insurance industry is one such heavily regulated industry, and certainly the state of the ORS indicates that it is, in fact, that. There's 13 some odd chapters of Oregon law that apply just to the insurance industry. There's, as you know, a whole division of DCBS that's all they do, and there are other state agencies that also regulate insurance. So the insurance industry, my conclusion is a heavily regulated industry, and so therefore the impairment before it becomes substantial really has to practically destroy the obligation that's been bargained for. Here, I should note that the what's bargained for with respect to these general liability policies is really they are designed and were, some of these policies we're talking about from decades ago, but they've always been designed to, for a property owner or whoever's purchasing the policy, to have insurance protection for unexpected not unforeseen property damage or injury to person. So there is a quality here that of the basic core obligation is that you're being protected for something that you don't foresee. And that's exactly what with these environmental claims was the case. You had, with industrial operations, you had rather routine releases of contaminants that were accepted business practice 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And that only later did it emerge that there was scientific evidence that, in fact, these contaminants were harmful and that, in fact, when they were released, they don't just go away, but they stay there or continue to cause damage. And so that's the more recent scientific evidence. And then there's also the more recent, from the date of these policies, the more recent decisions on the part of the Legislative Assembly or on the part of Congress that the release of these contaminants, in fact, is a strict liability situation for the property owners. But the occurrences of this would have been during the time that these policies were in effect. I go into that just to kind of put a little framework around what the obligation is that we're talking about being impaired here. And there's a inherent in that obligation some uncertainty. That's what you are bargaining for in the contract that you are entering into. Okay, as I mentioned, for it to be an unconstitutional impairment, there's a three-level analysis. That's the first level. It must be substantial. And then the next level, the next question is there a legitimate public purpose in that the legislation that is arguably impairing the contract is designed to address? And in this case, you can certainly see both from the policy statements in the Environmental Cleanup Assistance Act and just from the context of the bill that a legitimate public purpose here is to provide predictability about who is going to be paying and how cleanup costs are going to be paid for. And that certainly, in my view, meets the standard of being a significant and legitimate public purpose. And then the third level is whether there is a balancing of the impairment of the contractual obligation with the legitimate public purpose so that one could conclude adjustment of rights and responsibilities is reasonable and appropriate under the circumstances. And what's significant to note about that third question is that courts generally defer to the judgment of the legislature when weighing that. And so if the legislature has in fact enacted the provision in question, that is the legislature's determination that yes, this is a reasonable and appropriate balance between the impairment and the promotion of the legitimate public purpose. So again, my main point, there really, in my view, because of section 4 subsection 8, there is not an impairment. My second point, even if there is, it is not an unconstitutional impairment. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Richardson, we'll let you start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel that we're asking the wrong question. I mean, why don't we take a survey of attorneys and see what they think? Why don't we have ex-Chief Justice Domenis sit here and have a debate and see how that turns out? When you have a process like this, we're asking legislative counsel to give an opinion when opinions, thousands of dollars are being spent on opinions from people that have, in all respect, tremendously more experience in this issue than our legislative counsel who's limited. And so I believe that it is a mistake to put legislative counsel in a position where they're giving an opinion when you'll have opinions going to appellate courts and to the Supreme Court, and then the final decision being made by one vote, and And so opinions are just opinions. What we really need to be asking, in my opinion, is, not as a lawyer, is what is the policy and what are, you know, what are the considerations? I believe that legislative council, instead of giving opinions, should give us pros and cons. Because what happens is, depending on who the legislative council is, they control policy for this body. If they are really pro-insurance in this instance, they can come up with reasons why it should be this way. If they're really anti, and I'm not saying that, that you're anything but objective, but if they aren't, then it is going to play out that way. And then we say, wow, we have an opinion that says this is unconstitutional. This bill is dead. I mean, I've seen that happen here before. And I say, what do you mean it's dead? I can give you an opinion. I've been an attorney longer, you know. But that's not how it works around here. And so I think that it is not, in my opinion, appropriate for us to be asking legislative counsel to give us an opinion, a legal opinion, on something where there's millions of dollars at stake. Because there's plenty of those opinions out there. But I do appreciate coming in. You're coming in and talking about the release of contaminants and the process, the what is going to be the consideration by the court in making this decision. But ultimately, this is a policy decision that we make, and it's going to be decided by the courts no matter which way we go with this. Thank you.
And thank you. I'd just like to respond. I appreciate that. And but in testimony, we were reviewing the policy, and then we would hear from the opponent's side that it's unconstitutional. We'd hear from the proponent's side that it is constitutional. And being that I wanted an opinion that wasn't from the opponent or the proponent's side, my attorney happens to be legislative counsel, so I would like to hear their opinion. And so I understand your position that we should be looking at the policy, but that's what we were doing, and then enter in all the different opinions. Yeah. And so I want to have at least one opinion that I know isn't coming from one side or the other.
Perfect. And my comment was not just directed at this, but just generally speaking, we put a tremendous burden on legislative counsel to tell us whether something is constitutional or not when, you know, that goes all the way up, and then the court tells us that.
But yeah, it's
my point.
It's an ultimate opinion from up above somewhere.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond as well, and Representative Richardson. And this is much more of a big picture thing, but yes, all I am doing is offering you one view, and, you know, there are... You put two lawyers in a room, and within 5 minutes, there are 10 opinions, and that's all. Absolutely, that's all I am.
That's the problem with the one arm. On the other hand,
yeah. That's why after the hearing on this, I just about banned lawyers from my hearing.
And that totally makes sense, Mr. Chair. But the two things I do want to, significant things I want to say are that one, the cornerstone of the Legislative Council office is our nonpartisanship, and we really do strive for that. And two, our goal is to ensure that you make an informed decision when you make these very difficult decisions. So that's it.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dexter, I appreciate your last comment. As the Vice Chair and you were both speaking, that's actually what I was thinking. I would share with this committee, I don't feel intellectually capable of deciding this issue. I openly admit I don't have the education, the background, the knowledge, the industry experience. I don't understand the insurance industry. I definitely don't understand the industry's perspective. And so in the end, I have to rely on my professionals. And this, Dexter, you represent my professional. And so I just want to share that for the record. This is a tough one, especially when, as a citizen legislature, there's many of us on this dais. We just don't have that experience. And so I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for Dexter? Would anybody else like to hear an opinion from Dexter?
Thank you, Dexter.
Mr. Johnson, I appreciate you coming in as our counsel to give us an independent opinion. And sometimes we need those, but we still have to consider the policy as well. So as Representative Richardson pointed out, that's what we're primarily asking about, and somebody else will figure out whether that opinion stands or not. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'm going to stand at ease for just a moment. Bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection, Government Efficiency back to order from our recess. We are under work session on Senate Bill 814, and I'm ready for a motion. Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 814 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves Senate Bill 814 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Representative Thatcher.
Well, just like there can be 15 opinions with three attorneys or however the math works out, I'm not sure, but I have myself come up with several different opinions in different scenarios, and I'm also conflicted on this because impairing contracts is kind of a big part of my life, and I don't want contracts being impaired. But I also see that it works, this kind of regulation works up in Washington. Mm-hmm. And I can't figure out how, if we're so different down here, that statutorily and constitutionally so different that it couldn't also work down here. I haven't really been answered on that point. So, yeah, anyway, we'll see where I end up voting.
Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is obviously complicated, and it's going to end up back in the courts. And as a policy matter, if it was able to have been resolved in a timely manner, I don't think we'd be here. And so as I see this bill, it is an attempt to try and push something to resolution in a way that hasn't been able to get to resolution in the past. And so regardless, of what we do here, it's going to go back to the courts, but maybe it gives the courts a little bit more direction and maybe bring this thing to a head one way or the other, because dragging it out is not serving anybody's best needs.
Thank you. Other questions, comments? I appreciate the comments from both Representative Thatcher and Representative Richardson. I tend to agree with both of those points of view, and I know this is a difficult policy to consider, but it seems to me that the policy should work better than what it does in Oregon, and therefore I'm going to be supporting the bill. So, Samantha.
Representative Dinga Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 814, having received the required votes, is passed to the floor. A unanimous vote. Should we put this one on the consent calendar?
I'm with you.
I think that's a good idea.
Talk about speeding up the process.
Yeah, tiny day. Here we go.
Somehow I think we'd be chastised for
you
that.
Would be.
A volunteer for a carrier? Yeah. I guess I'm going to try this, so I'll carry the bill then. Anybody can jump in and help me along the way. So with that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 814. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 406A. Bob, description, please, of Senate Bill 406A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 406A allows party changing name due to marriage or domestic partnership to retain or change middle name and retain or change surname, declares an emergency and is effective on passage. Measure has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lively, a motion on Senate Bill 406A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 406A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wibley moves Senate Bill 406A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
That's coming up. We haven't heard it yet. Not today.
Was the bill about being able to use the name, your surname, how you want? No discussion. Samantha, can we have a vote, please?
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Yes. Aye.
Representative Smith?
No.
Representative Pennygeyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 406A, having received the required votes, passed the floor. And carrier for this bill? Representative Vega.
Okay, no. We both have unusual names, so you go for it. Yeah. I actually thought you had good comments about this bill previously.
So, Representative Vega Peterson will carry. Close a work session on Senate Bill 406A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 351A. Bob, remind us of what Senate Bill 351A is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 351A is the measure that authorizes tribal governments to invest in the Oregon Short-Term Fund according to existing statutes, changes the index used for calculation of investment cap on local governments and tribal governments from consumer price index for all urban consumers of the Portland, Oregon Metropolitan Statistical Area, the U.S. City Average Consumer Price Index. The measure declares an emergency and is effective on passage, has no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And if I recall, this was the bill that Senator Farioli and Senator Roblin sponsored. Mm-hmm. Just reminding myself what it is. Representative Wibley.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move Senate Bill 351A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wibley moves Senate Bill 351A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing no discussion, Samantha.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Pennygeyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Mm-hmm. Senate Bill 351A, having received the required votes, is passed. Carrier on this bill?
I'd love to carry this one.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Carry. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 351A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 683A. Bob, please give us a description of the bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 683A requires health practitioners to only consider a patient's needs and personal choices when referring a patient to a facility for treatment. The measure prohibits a practitioner from limiting referrals only to facilities the practitioner has a financial interest in or has an employment relationship with, and if a practitioner refers a patient to such a facility, the practitioner must disclose the interest to the patient. The measure also authorizes the Oregon Health Licensing Agency or appropriate board to investigate and discipline violations of the measure, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I appreciate all those who are here for this bill for patiently waiting through our other business. So with that, I'm going to start out with Terry Fitzpatrick, Gwen Dayton, and Deanna Godwin. Good afternoon.
Hi there. Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm Terry Fitzpatrick. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Urology Institute in Springfield, Oregon. And I am here in support of Senate Bill 683. OUI, Oregon Urology Institute, is an independent physician-owned urology-based clinic. We have 15 physicians. We have 5 PAs, physician assistants, physical therapists. We have 2 facilities in Springfield, 1 in Florence, and 1 in Roseburg. Within the group, we provide a variety of services, including CT. We have an ambulatory surgery center. We have a radiation center. We do urodynamics, ultrasound, full component. We do this because in the referral law, there's something called an in-office ancillary exception. And the ability to provide ancillary services is a critical component to coordinate care. the physicians, they set up the practice. The goal is to be able to take care of the patient from beginning to end of an incident. For instance, you have a kidney stone. You would ER, you'd come back into the office. We have a CT scan where you can be scanned. We have ultrasound where you can check. Then you can go right to the surgery center and have the stone taken care of. Other places, a friend of mine who lives in a different state took almost 2 weeks to get a kidney stone taken care of, pain medication, time off of work. The more times that the patient is touched by a different entity, the more cost it is, the more duplication, the longer it takes to do that. Second would be within part of our practice, and I guess to step back, urology basically, prostate, kidney cancer, bladder, female incontinence, testicular cancer are the major areas. In our incontinence center, a friend of mine, his mother was going to have surgery. I said, wait a minute, why don't you come and get a second opinion? Came to one of our physicians, a urogynecologist, ended up going to our specialist physical therapist who does pelvic floor, 4 sessions, no surgery needed. Again, the ability to provide in the office specialized care is critical. We're coming to you because over the past few years, that ability to provide integrated care in the office has been, there's been attempts to try to chip away at it. Can't do CT in the office, can't do MRI, can't do whatever for a variety of reasons. Usually it's, well, it'll be cheaper if we do it somewhere else, be quality of care, anecdotal stuff, but nothing that, you know, there's really any data. Federal government, MedPAC a couple years took a look at the whole issue of the in-office ancillary exception and said, we think that if you eliminated the in-office ancillary exception, wouldn't save any money. So they left the in-office ancillary exception. That has sort of moved these issues to the states. A few years ago, it came up in a House bill, didn't go anywhere. We would like to see rational, or basically the ability just to say, no, that makes sense. The in-office ancillary exception makes sense. Let's take care of it. So I'm here in this component of the bill to ask you to support 683.
Thank you. Good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holby, members of the committee. I'm Gwen Dayton. I'm the Oregon Medical Association General Counsel. The Oregon Medical Association represents physicians and physicians' assistants across the state. We're also in favor of this bill as it is amended. And I will say that those amendments are really in flux right now. We have a really terrific work group that just met today to do some more work on those amendments. I think we've reached some consensus on what those amendments will say. And they reach two guiding principles that this group has tried to adhere to. One is to ensure that appropriate referrals can continue. It's important for coordination of care that practitioners be able to refer appropriately. And sometimes in any they refer to, they might have a financial interest in. But that doesn't mean necessarily that it's the wrong referral. But one, we want to make sure that patients know that the entity to which they were referred is an entity that their physician or other practitioner has an interest in, which is existing law. But two, that patients have choice about where they go. If they don't want to go to that facility, they don't have to. They need to be told there might be consequences of that in terms of insurance coverage, but they can go somewhere else. And if the place they want to go is a place that the referring practitioner doesn't have an interest in, that referral can't be pulled for that reason, that they really do need to have the ability to go to another entity if they want to pay for it and they feel it's most appropriate for them. The referral can only be pulled or limited if there's a clinical reason why that was not right. But if there isn't a clinical reason, then the patient should have the ability to make those choices for themselves. So those are the amendments that we're working on actively. They're not ready yet because we just discussed them today. But I think that's where the amendments are headed, and the Medical Association supports that direction.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much. I'm Diana Godwin, and I am legal counsel for a group of independent practice physical therapy clinics. We have about 165 clinics in my group. I've represented them for some 25 or 30 years. And I'm really pleased to come to this committee today because this committee is entitled Consumer Protection. But you're also interested, I understand, in preservation of small business. And where those two interests can coincide is important. As I said, these clinics are located throughout the state, every small community. And what we've been seeing out there in the community is that as hospital systems grow larger and create their own ancillary service facilities, or as more and more independent practice physicians start up their own ancillary service practices. They start their own PT clinics. They start their own other services. And we're not here to say that should not happen. We're not here to say that, because I agree here that sometimes that's in the best interest of the patient, and the patient should have that choice. The concern we're having is that too often out there, when a patient tries to exercise choice to go to the physical therapist that they may have gone to last year for their motor vehicle accident or their work comp injury, tells the referring physician, no, I want to go to the clinic in my hometown, we're seeing too often that that physician will withdraw or restrict that referral. And that is what we're trying to get at here. We're also trying to get at the concern of just the fact that as we are expanding our methods of delivering health care service in this state, we know we're embarking in a brave new world for, you know, delivery of care to an expanded population of patients. That's great. We want to do that. But what's happening is all of these small medical practices are being driven out by the large hospital systems who encourage their physician to always refer in-house and discourage patients from going outside. Those small medical practices are withering. And what are we going to do when we need those facilities as we bring more patients into the insurance pool? You know, particularly for my generation, the baby boom generation, we're all going to need musculoskeletal care. Where are those physical therapists going to be if they're all driven out by, you know, these large systems? And it is happening. The referrals are just dropping. On Monday, I emailed all 165 of my clinics, and I said, this bill's coming up for hearing. And some of the hospitals are saying that's not a problem. Patients really do have choice. We don't discourage our physicians from allowing a patient to go to a PT clinic of their choice. I said, what's happening in your communities? I was flooded with email responses from every corner of the state. I've compiled those. I'm going to be providing them. But over and over and over, the single theme was, gee, this doctor's been referring to us for 10 years. We're their knee specialist. They're bought up by a system. Referrals dry up. You go talk to the physician. No, we're being told we are encouraged to refer just in-house. Patients want to come. Example after example of patients who say, when I told my doctor I wanted to go to my local PT, they said, well, we're going to cut the number of referrals, or we're going to not allow referrals. It shouldn't happen that way, but it's happening a lot. It's epidemic out there. And we just need to get a handle on it. We don't need to prevent, you know, in-office ancillary care services. We're not here to do that. We're here to protect patient choice, and we're here to protect small business medical providers because they're going to be needed in our system. So as I said, I'm going to be distributing this. It's like 14 pages, single-spaced. I've just excerpted, and I have not identified the PT clinics individually because I promised I wouldn't, because many of them have been retaliated against. But what I have said, I've called each of them an independent private practice physical therapy, comma, Gresham, comma, Sandy, comma, Central Point, comma, Medford, comma, Hillsborough, every Scappoose, everywhere these clinics are located, they're all giving me their stories. And this bill, Senate Bill 683, is very important. As Gwen Dayton said, we are working on amendments, and I would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments, and I know I have two members on the Health Care Committee on this committee as well, so I'm probably going to lean on them a little bit. But how does, you know, I listened to your comments, and I'm kind of thinking through this a little bit. I mean, some of these issues I'm wondering are they being generated by the insurance saying these are our providers, and so that's why we're sending you there, is because those are our providers, and so the doctors are, or hospitals or whatever, are saying, well, this is where you're going to get covered, so I'm recommending you go there. Sometimes I wonder if that's confusing this issue. It's certainly confusing me a little bit. And then trying to also, where I'm going to lean on my healthcare committee members is,
how does this bill fit in with our transformation move into CCOs, where you are looking at coordinated care, and how is this going to be, if this bill passes, how is that going to be integrated into that conversation?
You've got all the questions, absolutely. The insurance thing...
I don't have the answer.
Exactly right. And we are all struggling with this as we move toward new methods of healthcare delivery and new insurance models, exclusive provider organizations, where if a patient goes outside that EPO network, there is no coverage at all by the insurer, so the patient bears 100%. No question, that's out there a lot. And that's affecting patient choice, and not every one of us understands that with the cost of health care. There are PPOs, which are in-network, out-of-network. Some PPOs don't allow some providers in, and it's confusing for patients. But what we're trying to laser focus on with this bill is just making sure that the patient knows that they can have choice, but that they're also going to be informed that they should check their insurance coverage, because we don't want a patient to say, oh, well, my referring physician said I can go anywhere, and then find out their insurer didn't cover it, or only covers 50% as a co-insurance amount. And, oh, well, might argue with my insurance, well, my provider said I could go there, so you should cover it. No, I mean, it's a huge educational challenge out there for patients and providers as we're changing the system. Coordinated care organizations is a huge issue. I spent last weekend meeting with most of my clinics, and one of the questions is, how are we going to be integrating the existing small medical practices and, like physical therapy clinics or other small medical practices, how are they going to get integrated into these large coordinated care organizations? They can't afford the tens of thousands of dollars it's going to cost for them to get into the coordinated medical care record system so that you can have that exchange of information that's so critical to coordination of care. I don't know the answer to that, but we know we're going to need these providers. We don't have enough providers today. So you're right. I've just posed some more questions for you instead of giving you some answers.
Thanks, and I think Representative Kenny Geyer, did you have a question or should?
Well, I had a couple of short ones, and again, any panel that wants to address these, it may be addressed in the amendments. Overall, I do think we're trying to do integrated care. I understand if a hospital system, one doc refers to another and they're in the same Epic software, and they have a collaboration, a collegial, that makes sense. And patient access is important, and if you can get your physical therapy at the place down the road as opposed to go way back, that makes sense too. Making sure that patients have choice and being informed makes sense. So I'm curious about where the language is going in the amendment. There are some questions I have about the particular one, the A engrossed. Line 6 says the Oregon Health Authority may not impose additional restrictions on any referral. I'm kind of curious about where that came from. Like, whoa, what? What OHA may think about this. Terms of OLA's involvement, just a small catch. You have licensed nurse practitioners, et cetera. You have direct entry midwives kind of on their own. I would suggest adding licensed direct entry midwives, because the fact is they're not regulated if they're not licensed. And then, how informed, I don't see any rulemaking anywhere here, and so the health practitioner must inform the patient, like, how that happens, what gets qualified. I'm assuming some of these things are being worked out in the amendment, because this leaves a lot of questions, I think.
And I would suggest that we may want to hold those specific language
just
questions
get
on
them
the bill
until
we have those amendments. Otherwise, we're going to be talking about things that may be addressed in the amendments.
I just want to make sure that as you...
You nailed
your
work group, all the issues.
Yeah.
I love that you put that on the record, but I think it might be premature to have that conversation.
Okay, don't bother answering. Just know that the question is out there.
Unless you want to. I mean, if you want to make a stab at it, go ahead. I don't see any stabs coming.
No.
Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually think I'm going to hold back till I see the amendment, because I had very similar questions to the good representative next to me.
Okay.
So I'll hold tight.
Representative Johnson.
Well, just a question. Mainly it's more for you, Mr. Chair, but why do we have a health care bill in a consumer affairs committee? Hopefully we're not entertaining higher ed governance next. I mean, it would be best to keep our...
No, I'm always trying to expand my horizon. I have no explanation for that. Maybe there's a consumer element to having a choice of where you want to spend your retail dollars in the world of healthcare. I can't answer those sorts of questions. That's not in my purview. I got out of that one. any other questions for this panel? If not, thank you for coming forward and giving us your synopsis of this bill and where it's going. Up next, I'd like to have Steve Conklin, Patty O'Sullivan, and Dan Jarman. Before I go on, Representative Johnson, maybe the Speaker's office is making sure we're all informed about CCOs and our healthcare directions.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I'm here to testify on this bill. I'm not quite in support yet, but we're really getting there. We have met a number of times, and I think you'll be pleased with the amendments. The amendments do address many of the things you just mentioned, Representative Kenny Geyer, including rulemaking and those kinds of things, so that the department can, we don't have to garbage up the statute with, you know, you have to do this and that. We've come to some consensus on sort of, you know, what it means, but we want the rules to indicate that. I think in general that the group is working very well together, and we understand there are some problems. I think we could probably come up here and defend everything anybody says, but I'm not going to waste your time doing that. I want the bill to be a good thing. The consumers have a right to know about choice, and they also have a right to know that they need to check with their insurance, because I've personally been testifying on a couple of different bills this session where people say, but you didn't tell me that if you transferred me to the trauma center when I was unconscious, that and I didn't really want to go. Well, you had a subdural hematoma, and to save your life, that's where we had to send you. Sorry, you got a bill. But so it's that kind of thing, and we think they have a right to know, but neither the doctor nor the hospital nor a clinic clerk giving you a referral has any idea what your insurance will and will not cover. So they really need to take that upon themselves. And I think it's really important to let them know, so they don't believe that if we have a restriction on taking referrals back, then they don't believe that that's permission to go anywhere you want and get it paid for. So that it really is within, as we move again more towards CCOs and outside of CCOs, you know, we're looking at PEB and OEB, how should they work? Should they work more in a structure like a CCO? And then we have big healthcare systems that are working now with as a primary care physician and ancillary services being all on Epic and all talking. And so we're moving into a new world, but I think that we're taking that into consideration in our amendments and coming to an agreement. So I look forward to coming back and supporting the bill if we all agree on the amendments.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And I believe it was referred here because we were sick of seeing all the health care committees.
Get away from some of us.
You lobbied.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Steve Conklin. I am legal counsel for Oregon Health Science University. First of all, I'd like to thank members of the committee for allowing OHSU to participate with the work group in working on this particular bill. Well, we've supported the efforts of the work group, and we continue to support their efforts as we participated today in discussing the bill and the various amendments, which I think you'll see shortly. I want to voice support for the intent of this bill, which I believe is limiting improper referrals and giving patients information that will allow them to make an appropriate choice about their health care. We support, as I said, the efforts of the work group to move towards achieving that objective, and we think that the discussion today and the consensus that we achieved today are consistent with what I've described as the intent of the bill, and we look forward to seeing those amendments like you so that we can continue to support the efforts and the intent of this bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Chair Hovey and members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman, representing Providence Health and Services, and thank you for allowing us to testify today. We're staying very close to the work group activities on these amendments, and we very much hope to be able, when they're finalized, to say that we can support this piece of legislation. I also want to thank you, each and every one of you, for allowing us to come and visit with you this week to discuss this issue, which is a very complex issue, not just for this committee, but for any committee, and allow for Dr. Scott Foster with Providence to be able to share with you Providence's policies and contract language that explicitly prohibits us from only internally referring patients, and also sharing data about our referral policies that do show that a majority of our referrals go outside of our system. So thank you for allowing us to do that. Dr. Foster is here if you have any specific questions for you, for him. But again, thank you very much for allowing us to testify.
Thank you. And I would suspect that once the amendments are done, we will probably post this bill again for an additional public hearing as well as a work session before our posting deadline next week. I doubt whether we'll have your amendments in hand. Maybe we will by then. I don't know. It'll be close, I'm sure. But we will try to keep this on our radar screen. It sounds like an important bill that there's interest in moving forward with. So I appreciate your work. Are there questions of this panel? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question as I read through the bill, and I'm wondering if this has been considered or not, but it says a health practitioner may not limit patient referrals to facilities in which the health practitioner or an immediate family member of the health practitioner has a financial interest or that employ the health practitioner. Would this preclude or make it difficult for, let's say, a physician to refer a patient to a clinic that would also employ one of the physician's family members, as say a nurse or a technician or something? Has that been considered, or is that a problem at all?
I think as you're reading the current version, there's that implication, and I think the discussion today in the work group and the amendments that you'll see won't will eliminate that issue.
Thank you.
When you're talking about the employment relationship.
That's fine. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And you know, maybe the public hearing was maybe just a bit premature, but I think it's good for us to get the background and to hear people talk, and we'll be a little bit more up to speed with the issue when your amendments come back, perhaps. Any other questions for this panel? Not seeing any. I have one more person to testify. Thank you very much for
Thank
coming
you.
Forward.
Thank you.
Chris Altenhoffen? Probably didn't say that right, but.
That's all right. I'm used to it.
Thank Good you, afternoon.
Chairman. Committee members, my name is Chris Altenhoffen. I'm a diagnostic radiologist and the medical director from Epic Imaging. In Portland, not the EHR, but a independent outpatient imaging practice. We've been practicing in the Portland area for over 50 years. We're actually the largest and most comprehensive and oldest imaging practice, outpatient imaging practice in the state. We operate three centers in the Portland area. We employ 180 people in our centers. And we've always been known for our innovation, entrepreneurship, and cutting-edge technology, as well as our customer service, patient service. So we take a lot of pride in that. As I was driving down here, I was kind of struck. I knew there were a lot of different people testifying and coming at this from a lot of different angles. And I probably most closely dovetail with some of the statements that Diana Godwin had said. You know, we are an independent practice. We're not aligned with any hospital system, per se. And we are one of those groups that are out there right now trying to survive. Over the past decade, we've watched particularly the imaging market in Portland start to get carved up into pieces. It gets carved up by big hospital systems. It gets carved up into big subspecialty groups that install their own imaging equipment. And we've watched our volumes shrink continuously over the past 10 years from those factors. And we know, we're there, we're experiencing this every day. We watch those referrals dry up. We know that those referrals are not open referrals, which our group depends on. We cannot self-referral. We cannot, you know, we don't see patients and send them for their tests. We are totally dependent on outside referrals for our practice. And so we know when those referrals disappear, they've gone into the hospital systems or they've gone into these big subspecialty groups, and we no longer see them. So as Diana said, you know, some groups are withering out there. You know, right now, over the next couple of years, we're kind of fighting for our life, quite honestly. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, we have a lot to offer. And, you know, as baby boomers come of age, as we have more people insured through various programs, you know, we're going to need that capacity to take care and see these patients. The other factor is cost. We actually now our group has suffered through about 12 reimbursement cuts over the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. We stopped counting at 12. And the net effect is that we are now probably on average 30 to 40% cheaper for the same services that patients will receive in the hospital settings or even in their outpatient imaging facilities. With Medicare, we're close to 50% cheaper. So if you look at that the other way, they're almost twice as expensive as we are. And we can provide the same service, same level, the same technology, if not better technology, with more rapid turnaround, better customer service. I want to read you a patient account. This is a recent letter that was sent to me by a friend of a patient. Quote, she, the patient, had just been diagnosed with lung cancer, and she and her husband and teenage children were reeling from the diagnosis. Her doctor promptly ordered a PET scan for full staging and prognosis at a local hospital X. No other option or site for the test was discussed. The hospital's next available appointment for the PET scan was 9 days out, and the patient and the family were distraught about waiting that length of time to determine her prognosis. This woman called a friend who worked in the medical field and was told to call Epic Imaging, my practice. Epic Imaging worked her in the very next day with a report back to her physician that same day, a full week ahead of the hospital appointment. After this, another MD wanted her to have an urgent brain MRI, but the hospital could not get her in for 2 days. She called Epic again, and we had her in within 1 hour. Epic provided her with a CD of her images and a report to take with her to her first oncologist appointment. I'd also like to read to you a quote from the spokesman for the California Medical Association. In California, the corporate practice of medicine is outlawed, as is hospital ownership of physician practices. The quote, doctors on hospitals' payroll would be subject to administrators' rules on admissions, tests, and referrals, rather than being free to make decisions based on patients' needs. Physicians' sole interest is ethically to their patients. They don't have a legal duty to make the hospital money, and that's what we want to avoid. If hired doctors are required to perform certain procedures at their respective hospitals, outside competition and patient choice may suffer. And I will tell you, after working in the Portland area for 15 years, that's exactly what we're seeing. And it's becoming more and more prevalent. And it's getting harder and harder for the independent practices to survive. We are part of two CCOs there. But of course, CCOs right now only deal with public payers. So we're seeing this, you know, this addresses private payers as well. So, you know, for these reasons, Epic is fully in support of the specific provisions in this bill about
patient disclosure and giving the patients a choice of where to go. They may not always know, or they may not have a friend in the medical field to help direct them, but it would at least cue them that they can look elsewhere and find better or quicker or cheaper care for them.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming forward and sharing your perspective on this bill. Any quick questions, committee? We're about out of time. Not seeing anything. Thank you very much for your testimony today. And again, we'll be revisiting this subject in a future date. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 683A and adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.